36. One of my favorite places in the world is the Jefferson Memorial in Washington, D.C. I was a child the first time I went there. My brother was working as a page for Senator Charlie Rose. So we went up that summer and we stayed in his roach-infested apartment and we saw D.C. And one of the things we did was late at night we went to the Jefferson Memorial. And if you've never been, it's a wonderful place. It's right there on the Tidal Basin near the Lincoln Memorial, but it's right across the way. The Tidal Basin is pretty big, but it's surrounded by cherry trees there on the basin, and on the other side of it is Potomac River, and then across the river is Arlington. It's a beautiful spot of the world. And the Jefferson Memorial is noteworthy in that it's a dome, it's round. And we went there late at night, and we sat there in that place, and it felt sacred. I hate to even say that. It's a secular building of no real significance other than a memorial of one of the most impressive characters in our nation's history. But I have to say it. It felt sacred. It was a marvelous place. If you ever get a chance, doesn't matter how young your kids are, take them at night when all the crowds are gone, really late. All the crowds are gone. It's easier to find a place to park, and you may have to hike to it a little bit. But it's worth it just to sit there in the dark and enjoy that place. Well, you have to understand, for most of us, there are places like that in the world, these things that feel sacred. Well, the tabernacle for Israel was exactly that. But I also want you to realize, if you were in the camp of Israel, and you turned your back on the camp and you looked out, what you would see was unending arid desert. Not desert in the traditional sand dune sense of the word, but in the sense of scrubby little trees and rocks and mountains interspersed with flat barrenness and hardly a drink. It would have looked in very much the way it looks today, sort of like the surface of the moon with a little green. Not much to it. But if you turned to the camp, you would see 1.5 million people camping in tents, like a Bedouin city. But more specifically, you would see out by itself a little tent of meeting. Not much to it. But what was impressive, well, you would have seen a pillar of fire or a pillar of smoke, depending on whether it's day or night, there in perpetual attendance. So if you turned your back and saw outside the camp, barren and lifeless, if you turned yourself towards the camp, it was teeming with life. With this tiny little spot, a tent, with a feeling of sacredness to it, with a miracle occurring, with something visible, the presence of God. Well, what really was happening here was God was developing more of that sense. He was creating for them a sacred spot. And we mentioned it in earlier chapters, but Moses would go to the tent of meeting, but also other people would go. And they would go to that spot probably in their off time, probably for a great many of them in the night when there was no work to be done, when the pillar of fire was occurring, and they would seek the Lord. Well, I'd say that there's something to that. I think there's something about seeking the Lord in that private, quiet way. And I think there's also a sense in which we connect to the space in which we do it. I know it's not necessary, but God has a long history of developing places of safety, places of sacredness. And actually, the church has always been that. I think that was really what inspired the Middle Ages, the Christians of the Middle Ages, to build cathedrals, to build places that not only looked distinct in their usage, but also felt sacred. And when you look at the construction of a medieval chapel or a medieval cathedral, it is unbelievable engineering. It's unbelievable money spent. It really does blow your mind. But I have to feel at times, although it's not necessary, I understand, you have to feel like it was worth it. You really do. And that's not so much our mindset here. We develop buildings that, quite honestly, it's a nice room, but really are built for utility, built for comfort, not built so much around sacred. The closest we get to sacred is probably this table here, which has been with us a very long time. The work, actually, of the hands of one of our previous members, a man who loved the Lord. But I want us to get a sense of this today. And in so doing, we're going to read some of the details of this construction. And I know for some of you, it may not be all that jazz-worthy. But I'm fascinated with it. So if I'm fascinated with it, you must be too, right? So we pick up in verse 8. Of chapter 36. And all the skillful men among those who were performing the work made the tabernacle with 10 curtains of fine twisted linen and blue and purple scarlet material with the cherubim and the work of skillful workmen. Bezalel made them. So what we have here are tapestries created in which color is interwoven and then also the figures of angels. So he's creating walls of curtain, and these walls of curtain really are tapestries interwoven with sort of scenes of heaven, as if when you walked into this place, duplicated on the walls was supposed to be somewhat of a representation of what it must be like to be in the presence of God. And it's really what Bezalel is doing. By the way, I'm sure some of you are still considering that as a name. But Oholiab is just as good. Verse 9. The length of each curtain was 28 cubits. By the way, a cubit is 18 inches, so a foot and a half. So 20 feet would be 20 plus a half, 30 feet. It's pretty easy to calculate that if you get it. And actually, from the tip of my finger to my elbow is 18 inches. I have the perfect cubit. That's really what attracted Kimberly to me. She used to call me, just in those pet, you have those pet names, she's a man of the cubit. That's probably not true. Anyway, verse 10. And he joined 5 cubits to one another, and the other 5 curtains he joined to one another, and he made loops of blue on the edge of the outermost curtain of the first set. He did likewise on the edge of the curtain that was outermost in the second set. And he made 50 loops in one curtain, and he made 50 loops in the edge of the curtain that was the second set. The loops were opposite each other, and he made 50 clasps of gold and joined the curtains to one another with the clasps so that the tabernacle was a unit. Man, isn't the detail of that crazy? But really, I want you to understand, Bezalel, as he is dreaming up how to make this thing, and he's been given instruction, and he's sort of creatively approaching this thing, it's also neat because he's creating what really is a practical structure. I want you to realize, and we have to keep this in mind, Israel is going to be constantly on the move. In fact, they're going to be on the move longer than they thought. They're going to be on the move for 40 years. Wandering around the desert, and Bezalel and Oholiab are making a structure that is eminently practical. It can be taken apart, transported, and put back together. It's very practical. Although, as we get into the details of this thing, you're going to be questioning parts of the practicality of this thing, because it's monstrous. It is monstrous. It's a big, big place. Now, I also want you to realize that we're in a great situation here, because as we imagine the dimensions of this tabernacle, we actually have a pretty good example of that. For instance, this tabernacle winds up to be pretty close to the length of this building from front to back. I'm sure it was designed that way so that there would be this handy little illustration in front of us. That the length of this building is about the length of this original tabernacle. And I want you to realize there are two sets of curtains on the inside dealing with the Holy of Holies. And Andrew has a picture today. As you sort of look at this, you'll get a sense of it. And then there's this outer curtain, and there are two sets of curtains. So we're dealing with a tent with curtains. All of those are held up with poles. All of it's about 150 feet long of curtain. The outer set of curtains are made of leather. The inner set of curtains are tapestries. Somebody's got to haul every bit of that. Kim and I have always had a standard for how we own certain things. You know, do we want to keep this? Do we want to not keep it? And one of our tests has always been, would we carry this through the desert? Like, well, you know, is this worth having? I don't know. We want to get, well, would we carry it through the desert? Very little at that point. That we actually went through a phase where we wouldn't have done that with our children. Would we carry this one through the desert? To which my child will respond, in imitation of their mother, Doran, honestly. We got one of those yesterday, as a matter of fact. Charms me every time. Verse 14. Then he made curtains of goat's hair for a tent over the tabernacle. He made 11 curtains in all. The length of each curtain was 30 cubits, and 4 cubits the width of each curtain. And the 11 cubits in the same measurements, and he joined 5 curtains by themselves and the other 6 curtains by themselves. Moreover, he made 50 loops on the edge of the curtain that was in the outermost on the first set, and he made 50 loops on the edge of the curtain that was the outermost in the second set. And he made 50 clasps of bronze to join the tent together that it might be a unit. And he made a covering for the tent of ram skins, dyed red, and covering of porpoise skins above. So he's creating a tall tent that has 2 sets of curtains with all of these loops, and the 2 loops are opposite one another, so that this thing creates really a seamless, when it's put together, a seamless, complete unit. The detail is excruciating. And the expense and the work involved, just the work. You're out there in a desert trying to figure out, all right, we're out here in the desert. How do we weave? And all of these tapestry fabrics with all of this creativity, all of this artwork put into place had to be done in such a way that then it could be all broken down and hauled to a new location and set back up so it was the exact same every time. And you're creating a structure that cannot be seen into from the outside. The work. Man, the work. And not only that, it would have to hold up. It has to be durable. So he covers the whole thing in dyed leather, some of which is porpoise skin. Man. All for the Lord. All to create a place that's sacred. But it had to be practical. Now, we continue on with some of this practicality. Verse 20. Then he made the board for each tabernacle of acacia wood, standing upright. 10 cubits was the length of each board. So, 10 cubits would be how many feet? 15 feet. All right, so creating a thing 15 feet high. These ceilings are 10 feet, by the way. So another 5 feet. But I also want you to notice, this is acacia wood, and each of these boards is 15 feet long. Somebody's got to haul it. Kurtz Cochlin was telling us a story. They were working on something down in Mexico when they went to see our missionary, Mark Egolf. And they were carrying the whole thing in on burro, right? So you've got all these boards strapped to these donkeys, right? Well, the boards are longer than the donkeys by a fair amount. He said it was just crazy because you'd be walking through and the donkey couldn't see really what was going on in front of him. And once in a while, he'd get those boards straddled on a tree. and walk down. How do you, you have to back the stupid thing up and try. It was just this crazy. Somebody had to haul this stuff through the desert, 15 feet long. All right, we pick up again. 10 cubits with the length of each board. Verse 21, 10 cubits was the length of each board, and 1.5 cubits the width of each board. 1.5 cubits, how many inches is that? 27 inches. Somebody, hey, I had to write that down. 27 inches. Oh, I got to tell you, not easy to find stock 27 inches wide anymore, is it? So, 27 inches wide each board. By the way, this would have had to have been imported. Would have had to have been. This is expensive lumber, even for the day. It was not easy. And he made the boards of the temple, 20 boards for the south side, and he made 40 sockets of silver under 20 boards, 2 sockets under each board for its 2 tenons. Now, I want you to realize what's being described here. So these boards are 27 inches wide. Each of those boards has a tongue and groove on it so that the 2 boards lock together, creating a seam, but something that isn't rickety that you see through. So these boards are then tongue and grooved. Then the whole board is coated in gold. 15 feet long, coated in gold from top to bottom. Then at the bottom of each board and at the top of each board, you create a socket. So there are 2 sockets that fit side by side. The 27-inch board fits into 2 of those sockets and locks together. The whole thing becomes, at that point, imbricated. It's locked together like this. So you've got a socket that ties it to the next board, and then you've got tongue and groove between each board. All of it's coated in gold, except for the silver sockets that hold the whole thing together. Isn't that crazy? And all of this metal work would have been done with sand molds. Now, the one thing you know they had plenty of was sand. So you carve out a wood mold for what it looks like, and then you sink that into wet sand, and you pull the mold out, and it leaves an impression, and then you pour gold or silver in that, creating. And actually, sand molding was perfected in the Middle East, and it was perfected actually around 2000 BC. So this is an old technology that's still used in industrial uses today. There are a lot of companies that use specialized engine parts that are created in sand molds. Sand molds, an old process. So then you would pull out this rough thing that was poured in sand, and then you would burnish it and then polish it until it was smooth and perfect. Each of those sockets had to be done that way. Each of these boards had to be coated with gold, then burnished, and then polished. Can you imagine when the sun hit this thing? And just excuse the term, but man, this building was pimped out. This was blingalicious. It would have shone like the sun in and of itself. And what we find as we continue reading through this was that in the construction of this temple, over 2,000 pounds of gold were used. 2,000 pounds. And we'll say $1,500 an ounce in today's dollars. That's about half the price of the construction of this temple. If you put it in today's dollars, the temple cost around this tabernacle cost around $50 million to build. An unbelievable sum and an unbelievable amount of work. And then the whole thing would have been covered in dyed leathers just to create a place for God's Spirit to be. And then you had to haul the whole thing through the desert. So it's practical, but it's also art. Christian, it should be noted that the Israelites never, ever in their history developed an artistic heritage. You know how today, as you look through the Native American history and all that, you can identify tribes by their pottery. You can identify them by their designs, all of that. Well, that's true in the Middle East as well, except, you know what? Not Israel. There is not one piece of Israel's history that is considered unique in its art form, unique in its style. The Israelites constantly borrowed from everybody else. They used everybody else's stuff. There was nothing distinct and in and of themselves. The only piece of art and artifice that was uniquely theirs was this. Even when Solomon's temple was built, the Israelites didn't design and build it. A Phoenician did, a guy named King Hiram. It was Phoenician in its design. This is the only piece of art that Israel ever really created. And it was simply spent in this one task for the glory of God. All of their creativity, all of their engineering, all of their ingenuity poured into this one grand event. This was it. Now, we pick up in verse chapter 37, verse 1. Now, Bezalel made the ark of acacia wood. Its length was 2.5 cubits, its width 1.5 cubits, its height 1.5 cubits, and he overlaid it with pure gold inside and out. And he made a gold molding for it all the way around, and he cast 4 rings of gold for it on its 4 feet, even 2 rings on the side of it, 2 rings on the other of it. And he made the poles of acacia wood, and he overlaid them with gold. And he put the poles and the rings on the sides of the ark to carry it. And he made a mercy seat of pure gold, 2.5 cubits long, 1.5 cubits wide. And he made 2 cherubim of gold, and he made them of hammered work at the 2 ends of each of the mercy seat, and the cherub at the end, 1 cherub at one end, 1 at the other. And the cherubim had their wings spread towards the covering of the mercy seat with their wings, and with their faces towards each other. The faces of the cherubim were towards the mercy seat. So now he creates this box, which really represents God's presence with them. The mercy seat, which is where the sacrifice would go, the mercy seat where the blood would be sprinkled, and then the sort of the cherubim, those who cover, those who guard the presence of God. And if you ever want to know what this looks like, that movie, Raiders of the Lost Ark, was created as a perfect replica of what's described here. So, you know, when your kids are a little older, show them that movie and say, this is what the Ark of God looked like. And it really is. There's 100% agreement. This is probably what that thing looked like. It's pretty cool. But the director of that movie was a Jew, and he had a lot of Jewish pride, and he really felt like they wanted to represent this thing appropriately. But I want you to notice what it said. The whole thing was of a hammered work. Now, folks, this is a technique that's been used for centuries and centuries. But if you ever want to know, what does hammered metal become? How does it work? Well, go to Williamsburg and at some point stop into their silversmith shop. Have you seen, anybody ever seen tea sets from like the 16, 1700s? Everybody seen those? They're amazingly smooth, right? I had always assumed that was some sort of molding process. It's not true. I went to Williamsburg and watched what hammered work meant. And here's the way it's done. You start with a piece of metal, silver usually, and then you hammer that into the shape of like a teapot. And you think, well, you're just going to have dents all over it. Well, no, here's what you do. You take smaller and smaller hammers, and you take different anvils, and you sit there and pound on it until all the dents go away. All of it's by hand. I always thought that was some sort of molding. No, it's not. Those beautiful, old, smooth, perfect teapots, somebody beat on that with a hammer until it looked like that. The amount of work involved is excruciating. Well, Bezalel made these two angels, these two cherub, of hammered work. Well, remember, they're this big each. Their wings meeting in the middle. And don't you know, he's sitting there thinking, this is going to hold the presence of God. I better do my A work. The work was excruciating. Skip down to verse 17 of chapter 37. Then he made the lampstand of pure gold. He made the lampstand of hammered work, its base and its shaft. And you think, okay, got to create a lampstand. It's a big lampstand. It's going to hold little pots of oil. Those oil pots are always going to be lit. Okay, so I'm going to create that. I'll just make something basic. No, notice. Its base and its shaft, its cups, its bulbs and its flowers of one piece with it. And there were six branches going out of its side, the branches of the lampstand from one side of it, and three branches of the lampstand from the other side of it, three cups shaped like almond blossoms, and a bulb and a flower in one branch, three cups shaped like almond blossoms, a bulb and a flower on the other branch. I couldn't do it. Not a chance. Bezalel's weaving. He's molding. He's hammering. He's got it all going, man. Using the gifts that God had given him for this work. Now, I want you to skip down now to chapter 39. We're going to skip chapter 38 altogether. Chapter 38 goes into the cost of this. If you ever want to go through it, it's worth noting. Worth noting. So, we pick up in chapter 39, verse 1. Moreover, from the blue and purple and scarlet material, they made finely woven garments for ministering in the holy place, as well as the holy garments which were for Aaron, just as the Lord commanded. So not only is he making the tent, not only is he molding and casting and planking wood. By the way, how do you make a plank in the ancient Near East? Where's your planer? You just use an axe. Smaller and smaller blades, keep checking it, make sure it's flat, square, plumb. Ugh, the work. And then you got to create a wardrobe for all the priests on top of it. So now they're taking some of that stuff and they're creating garments for these men to wear as they minister before the Lord, and a special attention to the garments which Aaron would wear. And he made the ephod of gold and of blue and of purple and scarlet material and twisted linen. Yarn, by the way. They hammered out gold sheets. Notice verse 3. Then they hammered out gold sheets and cut them into threads to be woven in with the blue and purple and scarlet material. How do you create gold thread? You hammer out big sheets of gold. And then you sit there and carefully cut those into threads. And you better not get the hiccups. And then those threads, after being carefully produced, are then woven into the fabric so that when Aaron moves, gold shines amidst the blue and the purple. Amidst this finery. And then, of course, on top of that, we look at verse 6. And he made the onyx stones set in gold filigree settings. And they were engraved like the engravings of a signet, according to the names of the sons of Israel. So now, you got to cut stones. You got to be a gemologist, suddenly. You've got to be that guy who can cut stone. So Bezalel, don't you know the guy was just pulling his hair out by the end of this? As all of these workmen are working, and he's like, no, you can't do it that way. You got to do it this way, and we're gonna do this. And by the way, you know, that's a 30-cubit stone. Don't slip. Don't mess that up. We've only got a couple of them. No mistakes. And then you've got to set that stone in a special gold setting with the name of the tribe on it, so that as Aaron goes before the Lord, all of the names of the tribes of Israel are represented on his chest, born into the presence of God. Man, all that expense, all that work. And we skip down to verse 30 in chapter 39. And then they made the plate of the holy crown of pure gold and inscribed it like the engravings of a signet and said to it, "Holy to the Lord." And they fastened a blue cord to it and fastened it onto the turban above, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. Holy to the Lord. There is a discussion that's going on in archaeological circles right now, but there is reputedly a piece of Solomon's temple that is still in existence. Only one piece that's been found from that temple, dating from around 800 BC. It's a tiny little ivory pomegranate. And many people have tried to debunk it as a forgery. After reading everything I can read on it, after looking at the pictures, after looking at the inscription on it, I don't think that it is a fake. I think it's the real deal. But it's just a tiny little ivory pomegranate. And actually, Scripture tells us that these existed. And it would have been sewn onto the hem of the priest's garment. And on that tiny little pomegranate, it says, "Belonging to the temple of Yahweh in Jerusalem." That's all it says on there, just in pre-exilic Hebrew letters. Well, first of all, I don't know who owns that, but wouldn't that be the thing? But there is an understanding here. When I was 16 years old, I began to walk with the Lord. It was a new experience for me. I told you before, I had not read my Bible since my parents had given it to me in 1980. It stayed in the box, the original box, so that it would stay nice. I wanted to keep it nice. But actually, it was years later before I realized that God didn't want me to keep it nice. He wanted me to read it. Funny thought, huh? But when I was 16 years old, 15 really, I began to read that Bible. And the first thing I did when I was 16, as I really began to sort of grow in the Lord, I thought, you know what, I'm going to do a study of the temple. And I began to do a study at 16 years old. And yes, I know that that's nerdy. I mean, what 16-year-old spends his time doing that? Come on. No friends. Anyway, I began to do this study. And what struck me about it was the same thing that strikes me here. And it strikes me over and over again. I'm going to read this verse again, and then I'm going to skip over to chapter 40, and we're going to look at chapter 40 next week. But I want to reread this. And they made the plate of the holy crown of pure gold and inscribed it like the engravings of a signet, holy to the Lord. That's what was engraved to it. Holy to the Lord, which simply means set apart for God's service. Now, I want you to read, I'm just going to read for you from chapter 40, verse 9. "Then you shall take the anointing oil and anoint the tabernacle and all that is in it, and shall consecrate it and all its furnishings, and it shall be holy." And what struck me at 16 years old is the same thing that strikes me at almost 42 years old. All of the time, the money, the expense of person, talent, and effort was absolutely meaningless until it was wholly for God's use. And I can remember sitting in my room at 16 years old, and I came to that spot in my study of the temple, and I realized something. It didn't matter what I became, what I was gifted and skilled to do. It was actually worthless until it was holy to the Lord. Let me ask yourself, Christian. You are valuable enough, or God assigns you such value, as to die on the cross for you, as to reach out of heaven and redeem you from your sin, as to call you his own, and in fact to place in such a relationship in your life that you aren't viewed as slave to master, but really to view you as father to child. But have you ever come to a point in your spiritual life where you said of your life, of your inward person, of the being and everything else that you're doing, that I'm holy unto God? I'm set apart for Him. Is that your relationship to God? Or are you just the culmination of the expense of your parents to educate you, the expense of your teachers through the years to create in you skills and abilities, to be a person of intelligence and work? But how much of it is unto God? How much of you is holy unto the Lord? Or is that just a part of your life? Is that just a little box that contains your Sunday morning person? Or have you gotten to the point in your life where the whole thing's spent for Him and the whole thing's set aside unto Him? That's a good question. At 16, I wrestled with that. And at 16, my flesh lost. That's why I'm in ministry. What is the thing that you still hold from His reach, the thing that He's asking you to pay, that you're still afraid to stamp holy unto the Lord? I think about that little pomegranate. It's a piece of ivory, like 1,000 pieces of ivory from the ancient world. But that's the only one we have that says it's just for Him, just for His use. What are you? Let's go to prayer. Father, we just thank You for this word. It's significant. As we look at the construction, and as we look at the finery, and as we look at the impressive quality of it, we look at this piece of practical structure designed to be used. And we also look at the only piece of art this nation ever produced. But Father, the whole thing's useless if not inscribed with Your name. Father, create in us this place of beings who are holy unto You. Win every part and stamp Your name upon every corner of our lives. Break down those intellectual and emotional barriers. Break down the fear. Break down the greed that we hang on to things and cause us to just give over. Because I have an aspiration, Lord, that in every corner of my being, it would say, holy unto the Lord. And I have an aspiration, I confess, for every person in this room, that in the deepest, darkest parts of their minds, in every thought, in every act, in every secret dream, that it would say the same thing, holy unto the Lord. Father, that if we are artifacts, that if we are clay pots, please stamp it so indelibly upon our lives that we are wholly set apart just for You. And in Your name we pray. Amen.